You've no doubt noticed that gas prices are creeping up again. If it was just a matter of supply and demand, that wouldn't be the case because there's a glut of oil on the market. Here's Marianne Russ of Capital Public Radio to explain why you're paying more at the pump.
It's one thing to grumble about paying more to fill up your car. It's another thing entirely when you have 150 big rigs to refuel every day. Scott Blevins heads up Mountain Valley Express Freight Service in Manteca, about an hour south of Sacramento. He has operations in California, Nevada, and Arizona.
Diesel fuel for our company is roughly our third single largest cost.
With both gas and diesel prices around $3 a gallon in California, Blevins spends about $330,000 a month on fuel. Higher prices hurt Blevins, but not in the way you might think. Like many in the industry, he passes the higher cost onto his customers through a fuel surcharge. That makes it more expensive for them to ship their goods, and that means...
Ultimately, we consumers pay for it. I mean, if you look at your grocery bill lately, a large part of the cost of your groceries is due to fuel. Because they all come on a truck.
Blevins says business is down because his customers are shipping 15 to 20% less than they did a couple of years ago. And that's largely because consumers are buying less stuff. So what's driving the cost of gas up?
Unfortunately, it's not supply and demand.
That's Bob Vandervalk, a fuel pricing analyst.
Because supply is up, demand is down, and prices should be going down, and they did not.
Vandervalk is a consultant with 4Refuel, a diesel fuel distributor in Washington state. He says the weak dollar has a lot to do with it.
If the dollar is weak, crude oil goes up because everybody takes their money out of investing it in the almighty dollar or the euro and putting it into investing it in paper barrels of crude oil.
Vandervalk says that investment has helped push oil to around $80 a barrel, and that means higher prices at the pump. He says they'll probably keep climbing, in California at least, which has the highest gas prices in the continental U.S., could be at $4 a gallon by the summer. Esmail Adibi doesn't think prices will get that high. He's an economist at Chapman University in the Los Angeles area. But he is concerned about the effect of higher gas prices on the economic recovery.
When gas prices go higher the way it did, $1 per gallon over 1 year, what it means is kind of a tax on us. It's like we have less disposable income to spend.
Adibi agrees the weak dollar is playing a role in high gas prices. But he says there are a number of contributing factors, including the cold snap in the eastern part of the country, that increase demand for energy. In California, where unemployment is over 12% and the state budget has a $20 billion hole in it, Adibi says the gas pump isn't an effective place for consumers to be spending extra money.
Most of it is going to go to oil-producing countries, and that's not going to be any benefit domestically for our economy.
But it's important to keep things in perspective. That's according to Christopher Knittel. He's an economics professor at the University of California, Davis. He says when you consider the things we don't pay for, what he calls the social costs of gasoline, $3 doesn't sound so bad.
If we worry about climate change, if we worry about even more local pollution, such as smog, if we worry about the fact that our military is larger, the more oil we consume, all of those costs are not in that $3 a gallon. So from that perspective, $3 a gallon is actually a pretty good deal.
Compared to a year and a half ago, when gas in California was over $4.50 a gallon, $3 may not sound so bad. But the uncertainty around where prices are headed next makes it pretty tough for business owners like Scott Blevins at Mountain Valley Express Trucking to plan their budgets for the year. For NPR News, I'm Marianne Russ in Sacramento.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
The bills are coming due for Iceland's financial crisis. Back in October 2008, three of Iceland's banks failed. Britain and the Netherlands came to the rescue, covering $5 billion in losses. Now the president of Iceland has rejected a plan to repay the debt. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Reykjavik.
The Icelandic banks and their online subsidiaries with their high interest rates had attracted many savers from Britain and the Netherlands. When the banks collapsed 15 months ago, the British and Dutch governments stepped in to refund their savers who lost money. Britain and the Netherlands then negotiated a deal with the Icelandic government to get their money back, and that bill was passed by the Icelandic parliament. 2 weeks ago, though, the president of Iceland, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, refused to sign the bill. Speaking in a telephone interview afterwards, he explained why.
The fundamental basis of the Icelandic political system is that the people, the nation, is the sovereign power. And it is the duty of the president under the constitution to make sure that the people of the country will have the final say on law.
Grímsson had received a petition signed by a quarter of the population of Iceland, urging him to push for a renegotiation of the terms of the repayment. As a result of the president's action, there must now be a referendum on the bill. That has thrilled the bill's opponents, who've set up a pressure group called In Defence. It's headed up by high school teacher Johannes Thor Skulason, who says Iceland is not even obliged to reimburse Britain and the Netherlands, and even if it does pay some money back, it should be under much better terms.
Iceland is doing what it can. We're saying we want to pay back, but we're being made to sign a deal that carries within it a risk of national bankruptcy, a risk of Iceland being pushed back to the financial Middle Ages for years to come.
Certainly, the payback would hurt, with an interest rate of 5.5%. And Iceland already has an external debt of anywhere between 3 and 6 times its GDP, depending on who you listen to. Despite opposition, others within society and within government say that passing the law is fundamental to rebuilding Iceland's economic reputation and helping it enter the European Union. So the country just needs to bite the bullet and move on without the complication of a referendum. Iceland's finance minister, Steingrimur Sigfusson.
What do you think would have been the outcome in the United States if the taxpayers had got a chance to vote about the bill, the bailout? I mean, just imagine. It is not an easy task to get the voters to accept increased taxes and economical burdens because of irresponsible behaviours of bankers.
Sigfusson is hugely frustrated at the president's decision not to sign the bill.
Obviously, the case is immensely unpopular in Iceland, and quite understandably so. None of us like this, but that doesn't alter the fact that we need to deal with it. We need to solve it so that we are able to move forward and continue our economical restoration.
The Icelandic government announced today the referendum would take place on March 6th, but there are still people on both sides working to try to compromise and avoid the possible further political and economic turmoil that a referendum might bring. Finance Minister Sigfusson says whether a referendum happens or not, there's something deeper going on in Iceland, moving away from what he calls the culture of neoliberal greed.
I can be very frank about it. What we need to abolish is this neoliberal greed philosophies that were driving things in the bubble years. What we want to build, re-establish in Iceland is a strong Nordic welfare society with equal justice and equality.
Icelanders themselves, and there are only 330,000 of them, are divided on whether the president did the right thing or not. But regardless of their views on this particular bill, many share the finance minister's views that things simply got out of hand, and it's time to get back to more solid, dependable Icelandic ways. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Reykjavik.
Economic trouble is creeping closer to a place that was sheltered until recently, Montana. The state government has money, the housing market is relatively stable, but in Missoula, a big employer is shutting down. Montana Public Radio's Emily Ritter has the story.
Ken Lyles was born and raised in Montana. He and his wife Susan have 4 children and 5 grandkids and have lived in Missoula most of their lives.
I had intended to retire at about 62, which is 5 years from now, and this kind of changes everything, and I really wasn't prepared necessarily for this outcome.
On December 14th, the paper mill Lyles has worked at for 30 years announced it was shutting down. Smurfit Stone laid off 417 people, the biggest blow to the state's economy since the recession started. So Lyles is trying to figure out what will be next. He says he's too young to retire, too old to go back to school.
I'll be 60 years old when I get out of the two-year program that they offer. And in all fairness, who's going to hire a 60-year-old guy, you know?
It's a challenge a lot of the laid-off workers at the mill are having to grapple with. The average salary at Smurfit Stone was $70,000 a year. Compare that with the average salary in Missoula, just over $40,000. Lyle says he'll never find something else that pays that kind of money in the state.
I really don't want to leave. We don't have a fancy house, but it's our house, you know. And I love Harleys. I told my wife that if I have to, I'll go work at the Harley shop. And she just shakes her head and says, you know, you're selling yourself short. And I keep telling her, I am short.
About 70,000 people live in the Missoula Valley. It's nestled between the Sapphire, Bitterroot, and Mission Mountain ranges. This western half of the state relied on the timber industry for the better part of a century, but production has slowed drastically in the last 30 years. President of the United Steelworkers Local 885, Bob Johnson, says 26 mills have shut down since 1990. Six have closed their doors in just the last 3 years.
The types of industry that has left Montana isn't returning, and I don't see it returning anytime in the near future. At this point, I think Montana's just going to start seeing what this economy is actually impacting us. It could be very frightening for the state.
Businesses in downtown Missoula are also dealing with some big changes all of a sudden. Macy's announced this month that they would close their Missoula store, one of the downtown's anchor retailers.
To have this happen does, you know, impart a little bit of fear.
Julie Hilly opened her boutique in 2008, just months before the economy tanked. She has really relied on Macy's customers who walk by her store.
When people were not able to find things over at Macy's, the employees at Macy's were always so good about referring those customers down the street. And I think that's the key.
At Smurfit Stone, the fence around the mill is dotted with hard hats left by workers leaving their shifts for the last time. Kim Lyle says he's not just losing a job, but feels like he's losing part of his extended family.
Like I always try to tell people, don't feel bad for soon, I will get by. It breaks my heart to see what's happening to these young kids that are just starting out in life, you know. I would like to see them have the same opportunities that we had, and I don't see that happening.
Economists say the Missoula area recession may have been slow to arrive, but isn't likely to go away until late next year. For NPR News, I'm Emily Ritter.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Now we're going back to the dark ages to learn something about the American economy today. We often hear that America's global dominance is coming to an end, and history offers a scary model, Rome. When Rome fell, Europe collapsed into the miserable dark ages. But as Hannah Jaffe Walt and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money explain, the dark ages might not have been so dark, economically speaking.
Do you want to know why we've all been taught that the Dark Ages were so dark? It's all about spices.
Spices can tell you a clear, quick economic story. You walk into a spice store.
Like Penzi's in Grand Central Station in Manhattan.
So here we see ginger from China, anise seeds from Spain, caraway seeds from Holland.
This is Tom Standage. He wrote An Edible Canada. History of Humanity. Yeah. And he says, look at this. You have spices from all over the world. Clearly, you're trading with the whole world. You're doing well.
Ancient Rome was like that, too. They also loved spices. Maybe more than us. They smothered their food with them.
Delicious. But then it's the Dark Ages. From around 500 to around 1000 AD, all after Rome fell, dinner was bland, and so was lunch. Spices, or at least any evidence of them, almost completely disappears.
Well, if you can't see the spices, it's a question of, you know, is absence of evidence evidence of absence? And does it mean that trade really has fallen off?
Well, that's exactly the question we are trying to figure out today. So now we have to leave the spice store. We have to go back to the studio and talk to Michael McCormick. He's a historian at Harvard who thinks he's found some alternatives to spices to figure out just what was going on in the Dark Ages.
Rats are fantastic. I'm talking about the black rat, Rattus rattus.
Rat bones. McCormick tells us rat bones are completely changing our view of the Dark Ages.
That's because if they didn't have spices, it doesn't necessarily mean that Europeans in the Dark Ages were not trading with the rest of the world. Rat bones, it seems, prove that, in fact, they were.
Because rats like to go where people go.
They like us. They're very fond of us. They like to be close to us, right, as you may have noticed.
Right. We don't like them very much, but they like us.
The feeling's not mutual.
See, Rattus rattus, the black rat, is not particularly ambitious.
No, they won't travel more than a few hundred feet from where they're born, at least not on their own 4 feet.
They don't mind being transported passively, especially if they're in a nice, dark, moist place with lots of grain, like the bottom of a ship.
So, a rat is born in, say, Alexandria, Egypt, rides a trading ship to Italy, dies, and 1,500 years later, some archaeology grad student digs up its tiny little bones, and suddenly, we know someone in Egypt was trading with someone in Italy.
For centuries, we had so little information about the economy of the Dark Ages. We had almost no spices. There were so few texts having anything to do with economics. Right, Mike?
Very few texts.
And so all the big historians, the textbooks I read in college.
Yeah, same for me.
Yeah, they all assumed, hey, they had no spices. They weren't writing about trade. They must have been broke, isolated, sad little economies.
But then those rat bones showed there was all sorts of trade going on.
And not just rat bones. There's this new diving technology, and we've been finding all these shipwrecks from that period.
The internet, also new innovation, has transformed scholarly collaboration.
There are new discoveries all the time, big ones.
Well, I got an email, and the email was headed, "Wow," with an incredible number of exclamation marks after it, and I nearly fell off my chair. I never had expected to see anything like this.
Kevin Leahy is from the British Museum, and he's talking about the mother of all So You Think You Knew the Dark Ages discoveries.
You might remember this one. Just last summer, they found 1,800 gold pieces from 7th century Anglo-Saxon England. This one find is something like three times bigger than all the artifacts from that period combined.
And it and the rat bones and the text all have one clear message. These early medieval folks, who we've all pitied all these years, so broke and alone, they were rich.
At least richer than we thought they were.
Yeah, and they were doing business all over the globe.
At least the part of the globe that they knew about.
The Dark Ages really are all misnamed.
They weren't so dark. And they weren't all that sunny either.
Let's call them gray.
The Gray Ages. And let's keep looking for rat bones. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank. Committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.